worth $200,000. Garcia apparently had been in the dumps over his pending divorce, a second offense drunk driving case, and a count of domestic violence. McDermott eventually admitted that she slit his wrist after finding him in the carbon monoxide-filled garage in a semi-conscious state with the empty pill bottles. She claimed that Garcia had wanted her to finish him off if the other attempts at suicide had failed. McDermott, who appeared in court yesterday in a wheelchair because of unspecified health problems, is now being held in lieu of $500,000 bond. Coming up on 8:11, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. NFL Monday Night Football, Tennessee beat Dallas 28-14. The NBA, the Bucks were off. The Bulls beat the Knicks in double overtime, 116-115. The Bucks play in Portland tonight. The Bulls are off. Now, that forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, November 6th, Election Day. Cloudy and windy, light rain this morning, a high of 48. Some rain just rolled through the area. Some more on the way, according to the radar. And it is 48 in Racine, 47 now in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show probing into one of the most remarkable weeks in American military history and involving a group of exceptionally brave, courageous American soldiers who were under siege in the most desperate sort of way. They came to be known collectively as the so-called Lost Battalion, and their story is told in a riveting new book called Never in Finer Company, The Men of the Great War's Lost Battalion. And the author of the book, Edward G. Lengel, is a renowned military historian with a number of fascinating books to his credit, including To Conquer Hell, Thunder and Flames, Americans in the Crucible of Combat, 1917-1918, and a number of books about George Washington as well, including This Glorious Struggle, George Washington's Revolutionary War Letters. This latest book about this dramatic moment in the First World War, again, is called Never in Finer Companies. It's published by Da Capo Press. And Dr. Edward G. Lengel, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's good to be with you, Greg.
I'm very, very honored to be speaking with you. Very briefly, because we have lots to talk about with your book, I do want to make sure to ask you what it means to be chief historian of the White House, which is one thing we read in your biography.
Well, I was chief historian of the White House Historical Association for a couple of years, although now I'm a full-time independent writer. And as chief historian of the White House Historical Association, I was in charge of knowing everything there is to know about the history of the White House from its construction to the present day, as well as its inhabitants. So there's, as you can imagine, not just today, but over the past 200 years, there's been a lot of drama there.
For sure. I also noted that you are a former editor-in-chief of the papers of George Washington. And, of course, George Washington is the subject of a couple of different books and a number of articles that you have written. Can you just say a very brief word about what an editor does with something like the papers and letters of George Washington?
Well, sure. I was there for 20 years and ran the project and created a number of new ventures like the Martha Washington Papers and the like. The whole goal of the project was to collect copies of all the known letters to and from George Washington, to transcribe them into print and to publish them. So I got an intimate understanding of how the man lived, how he lived and breathed every day. I got to look behind the scenes, so to speak, and get to know him as a human being, which is why I've written so many books about him.
Hmm. I am so grateful for this latest book, which is an extraordinary account of a truly extraordinary moment in the First World War, which, of course, is a conflict which we continue to grapple with a century later, grapple to understand just what a horrible conflict it was and how it transformed not only our country but the whole world, and certainly the lives of those who fought in it. One of the choices you make in your book is to focus in particular on four different men who were involved in this horrific fight at the Battle of Argonne in 1918. Explain who these four men were and why you thought this was the most effective framework within to tell this larger story.
Well, I'll start with my overall goal, which is to show that this war, like other wars, is really the story of individual human beings, and that the best way to understand it is to look at the people, to have compassion for them, to understand what they experienced and what they did with those experiences, because then we can see them truly as like ourselves. I think too often we look at World War One and other wars, and all we see is the terror and the destruction, and we forget that these are the stories of real human individuals that we can look at and that we can learn from. We can learn not only the course of great trial and great challenges, but we can learn some uplifting facts. We can learn about courage, and we can learn about hope, and that's my goal in this story. My four individuals are three of them Medal of Honor recipients, two named Charles Whittlesey, who originated, his family originated from Wisconsin, and George McMurtry, both of whom were leaders of the Lost Battalion, themselves blue bloods, very wealthy New York City professionals. The third is Alvin York, who is my third cousin, and so I have an important personal connection to him. Sergeant York, as he's later known, was involved in the action that rescued the Lost Battalion. A lot of people don't know that. And then my fourth individual is the great journalist and sports writer Damon Runyon, who, in addition to covering the World Series and boxing, writing a biography of Jack Dempsey and the Kentucky Derby and all the rest, he really wanted to be a war correspondent. He went over to Europe in World War One, and he actually met the men of the Lost Battalion just as they were emerging from the Argonne Forest, and he told their story. He brought their story back home to America and helped Americans to understand how important this was for their country.
And it sounds like one of the things that he did that was so important was that he spoke to common soldiers, a number of them, and seemed more interested in hearing from them than hearing from, for instance, generals and other officers of the higher echelons of the military. And in doing so, it sounds like he was, in a sense, forging new ground or a new understanding of what a war correspondent should do.
That's exactly right. And Damon Runyon was a different kind of journalist from a lot of his contemporaries. And there's one story that shows that. One of Damon Runyon's best friends was a lightweight champion of the world, Benny Leonard, who was from the Lower East Side of New York City, a Jewish boxer. And Benny Leonard had adopted this young kid from an orphanage named Fly Gilbert. Well, Fly Gilbert went off, joined the military in World War One, and was sent to fight in the Argonne. And when this happened, Benny Leonard asked Damon Runyon to go check up on the kid to see how he was doing, spend some time with him. And that was what Runyon did. One night in the Argonne Forest, Fly Gilbert, who's just a private in the 77th Division, is sitting in a shell hole being shelled, and this guy crawls up to him through the mud with a very nice, natty uniform that's now stained with dirt, flops into the shell hole with him and says, "Hello, I'm Damon Runyon. I'm a reporter from the New York American." And those kind of things just didn't happen back in those days. Runyon pointed the way toward a new type of war reporting that was very personal.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Edward G. Lengel about his book, Never in Finer Company, The Men of the Great War's Lost Battalion. This is the story primarily of the men of the 77th Division who made their way into the Argonne Forest of France and then found themselves cut off from the rest of Allied military forces and were, in a sense, not exactly lost, but very much stranded, cut off, and suffered terrible deprivation and crippling losses before finally being rescued. It is a stirring story and haunting as well, and told in remarkable detail in this new book by Edward G. Lengel. I learned a lot about this conflict, about World War I in general, and I also learned about something that I had never known anything about before until reading your book, something called the Plattsburgh Movement, which is the story, in a sense, behind the first two of the four gentlemen you mentioned at the top of the interview, whose stories are so thoroughly told. Explain to our listeners what the Plattsburgh Movement was all about and its significance for the overall war effort and, in particular, the story of this Battle of Argonne.
I think many people would find the story significant for today as well. The story has a lot of appeal to it. Former President Teddy Roosevelt, along with a number of others, had the idea that even if the United States is not in a war, that it's important to train our country's best young men, by which he meant the blue bloods, you know, the people who were the sons of fortune, the ones who went to private schools, the ones who had everything kind of given to them, that they should go to civilian training camps in the summertime, which they called Plattsburgh camps because the first one was near Plattsburgh, New York, and that they should learn to be physically fit. They should learn rudimentary basics of tactics and military training. But the most important thing for them to learn was a sense of civic duty and responsibility, this idea that those to whom much is given need to give a lot in return, and that they had a responsibility to give back to their country. Now, people like Charles Whittlesey, who was a wealthy New York City lawyer, and George McMurtry, who was a millionaire stockbroker, were just those type of men that Roosevelt was looking for. They went to the Plattsburgh camps in 1915 and 1916 before we were in the war. And then when we did enter the war, even though they were not required to serve in any way, McMurtry was in his 40s, they felt that they had a responsibility, because of what they'd learned at Plattsburgh, to go and get commissions as officers and go to get training and learn to fight. That's what they did. They joined the 77th Division as officers. And you can see in their fighting in the Argonne this kind of dedication to their men, this responsibility, these feelings that they had to give everything that was in them, were principles that they had learned from Plattsburgh.
I appreciate the way you tell this story, because it unfolds within another reality of the First World War, namely that so many of our military leaders in the First World War were not adequately prepared for what was, in a sense, a new kind of warfare. And we certainly saw that played out in quite a brutal way in this Battle of Argonne. Just speak for a moment about what I'm talking about.
That's true. At the very highest levels of command, from General Pershing to his generals and his other officers, they really did not understand this new type of this new type of warfare that they were going to face. And they had a fairly simplistic belief that if they just attacked frontally with a lot of energy and with a lot of aggressiveness, that eventually they would win. It was a very simplistic view of the war. That certainly had an impact, and many men lost their lives because of that lack of understanding. But you also see among the field officers, lieutenants, captains, majors, and the rest, they certainly also did not understand what they were about to face, but it was their sense of loyalty and devotion in episodes like this that helped them and their men to get through. It gave them this perseverance that allowed them to learn the lessons, learn the hard lessons, fight their way through, and eventually overcome.
You've already mentioned the fact that Sergeant Alvin York, who is one of the great heroes of this story, is someone to whom you are related as a third cousin. And his story is particularly remarkable, and not just for his heroic exploits on the battlefield, the way in which he helped secure, in a sense, the rescue of the 77th Battalion, but just the story of who he was personally and the deep, conflicted feelings he had about being a soldier at all is particularly remarkable. Tell our listeners more about your third cousin, Sergeant Alvin York, and this facet of his personal story.
Certainly there's a lot of tragedy and sorrow in the study of war, but a man like Alvin York provides a counterbalance to that. To me, he provides a sense of uplift and hope. If you look at his story, he was a man who came where my mom's family came from, the hills of East Tennessee or along the Tennessee-Kentucky border, a very remote region whose people are deep in their culture, they're strong in their faith, but they're also people who understand violence. They live and grow up with violence and learn about it. York carried that background with him. He was drafted into the 82nd Division. He was conflicted about whether it was God's will that he fight or not, whether it was all right to kill a man even in combat. Eventually does make his decision that it's the right thing to go, but he still carries strong feelings of conflict inside him. And his great action of October 8, 1918, when he and some others capture 132 German prisoners, York kills probably 20 to 30 Germans in that one action by his own hands with his rifle and with his pistol. And after the battle is over, he's treated as a hero. He will receive the Congressional Medal of Honor. But he also has feelings of guilt. He has feelings of sorrow for what he's done, for the lives that were lost. And after the war, where other men, you see other men around York are crushed by their memories, by their feelings of guilt and their feelings of sorrow, York shows a different direction. He takes the celebrity that's given to him. People give him a farm. They give him money. He's offered all types of opportunities to earn extra income. Instead of using that money for himself, he channels every single penny that he receives into charity for the Alvin York Foundation to help the poor people of East Tennessee, the poor farmers. And it's by that act of giving to others after the war that York finds peace where others do not. So for me, that shows you that even when you look at stories like this, you can find things that uplift you and that give you a sense that there is good in humanity after all.
One of the stories of your book is of the extraordinary diversity that is part of America's fighting force in the First World War. And to help us understand that, you actually paint a really intriguing picture of New York City in the summer of 1916, saying that it bore similarity to a Picasso painting. It was a misfit, hodgepodge kind of place, its pieces not quite fitting together. Explain how this is crucial to our understanding of the overall U.S. Army as we entered the First World War.
Well, nowadays we're used to thinking of New York City as being a symbol of America. Nobody would doubt that New York City is American or part of America. But 100 years ago, the situation was different. New York was in a period of transition. People thought it had become something strange and something different. It was no longer the New York City of the founding fathers that they knew. And the reason for that was the immigration. It had been transformed over the previous few decades by millions of immigrants from all over the world, but particularly from Central and Eastern Europe, who had moved into Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, places like that, to the point that they had utterly transformed the city. There were many people, including New Yorkers, who feared that New York was no longer really American, and that in a time of crisis, in a time of war, that it would not be faithful to the United States. And what this story shows in the story of the Lost Battalion, you get these guys from the Lower East Side. You get guys who themselves are first or second generation immigrants, many of them still speaking their native language. In fact, when this division moved to the front, the Germans thought an Italian division had moved into the front lines because they heard the guys talking to each other in Italian. When they are moved up to the front as part of the 77th Metropolitan Division, and they go through experiences like this one in the Lost Battalion, they and their officers, who come from very different backgrounds, as well as replacements are brought in from other parts of the country, come to depend entirely on each other in the pocket in the Argonne Forest. They have nobody else they can depend on. They bond completely, as only soldiers can do, and as only veterans understand this. And part of my story is, as the Lost Battalion of these immigrant soldiers comes out of the Argonne, Damon Runyon hears their stories, talks to them as individuals, then writes back home to America, and through his columns tells their story as an American story. And he says, these guys may have come from Italy, or they may have come from Germany or Russia or China or anywhere else, and yet this shows that they're all Americans. This is the story of us. And you don't really see, after World War One, you don't see that doubt about New York and about America anymore. You see a sense of confidence that this country can pull together whatever our backgrounds may be.
As for the story of what these men experience and are forced to endure, we leave it to our listeners, of course, to read your book and to read your account of just what transpired, especially over the course of those 5 days when the men of the 77th Division were essentially cut off from the rest of our fighting force and cut off from all supplies, suffering not only terrible loss of life, but also terrible deprivation of every kind. Because this is a story that is, in a sense, legendary, what kind of challenges did you face as a historian in trying to tell this story as truthfully and as accurately as possible? How much legend / fiction did you have to, in a sense, sort of sift through and discard in order to tell us as close to a completely true account of this as you did?
There is a lot of legend and mythology. A lot of it dates even from the time of the battle. For example, there was a story that Major Charles Whittlesey, commanding the Lost Battalion, received a German surrender note telling him to surrender after several days in the pocket, and that when he read the note, he said, "Go to hell." And that was what led his men to continue the fight. The truth is, and Damon Runyon found this out, he asked Whittlesey, "Did you really say go to hell?" And Whittlesey said, "No, I just smiled and passed the note on." Nevertheless, newspapers didn't want to hear that. They didn't want to hear the truth. They continued to report that Whittlesey said go to hell because they thought that was a better story. That was one of the things that upset Whittlesey so much after the war was over. There's that story. There's other stories about the pigeon, Cher Ami, which is a wonderful story, actually, that they had only one pigeon left and had to release the pigeon to get word out of the pocket that the troops were being shelled by their own artillery. Now, that part is true. However, most likely the artillery fire was stopped even without the pigeon having brought the message out. But, you know, nevertheless, the human stories are the most appealing ones. And if you look at the actual records, you can see that the truth is really much more fascinating than the fiction.
Part of this story, of course, is of how these four men in particular are able to move on from the horrors that they experienced, and that's also a very important part of this story. We do read that the so-called Lost Battalion, those who survive in order to return home, are greeted as conquering heroes. Just explain the importance of this story then.
It's a difficult process for many of them. Most of them, like Whittlesey, don't want to be treated as heroes, and McMurtry doesn't want to be treated as a hero. They never asked for the Medal of Honor, which, of course, they received. They certainly never asked to be trumpeted in the media. They were forced, and imagine this, I find this incredibly shocking. They were forced the year after this battle to return to the scene where they fought and to reenact it in front of the cameras for a popular silent movie. And you can only imagine what went through their minds as they had to do this. They had to experience this. And so they come home and they deal with the celebrity. They also deal with their own memories and their own fears, but also they deal with the memories of how they stuck together and how they were comrades. That's what ultimately pulls them out of it. There's a Lost Battalion Survivor Association that's formed, and every year George McMurtry appears in front of the association and he lifts a toast, and the toast harkens back to something Whittlesey said to him as they left the pocket. And he says, "Gentlemen, we shall never be in finer company than we are right now." And that's something that memory of their togetherness is something that ultimately brings them out.
It's an extraordinary book, and I heartily recommend it to anybody listening to us. And the book, again, is titled Never in Finer Company, The Men of the Great War's Lost Battalion, published by Da Capo Press, and the author, Dr. Edward G. Lengel. Dr. Lengel, congratulations on a marvelous book, and thank you so much for being part of today's morning show. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Greg.
The time is exactly 8:38. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's morning show is from the archives. Many WGTD listeners, I hope, will remember a conversation I recorded with Harlow Giles Unger about a book called The Last Founding Father, in which he examined the life and legacy and career of our fifth president, James Monroe. His latest book is called Lion of Liberty, Patrick Henry and the Call to a New Nation. It is a very insightful look at this important, charismatic American and the difference that he made in America's efforts to throw off the shackles of British rule, and also some of the ways in which he was ultimately also a divisive figure in our new country, and particularly in that volatile period between our victory in the Revolutionary War and George Washington's inauguration as our first president in 1789. That is a period of time we don't often pay much attention to. So I'm so grateful to Harlow Giles Unger for creating such a fascinating book, which offers us rich insights into this really crucial moment in our nation's history. And he joins us for the next few minutes to talk about his book, which is published by Da Capo Press. Harlow Giles Unger, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
One of the intriguing things about Patrick Henry is that he seems to be a figure who is among the greatest orators of his generation, maybe the greatest among all those founding fathers, and yet also someone who on the surface had a lot of sort of had a very rough-hewn kind of exterior, which said a lot about where he came from. Can you just speak a moment about this intriguing mix?
Yes, indeed. I believe that Patrick Henry was the second most important founding father after Washington. His great speech, "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death," is known by most school children in America, but few Americans know what Henry really meant, and even fewer know anything about Henry the man himself. By "Give Me Liberty and Give Me Death," Patrick Henry was railing against all big government. He was not just intending to throw off the yoke of the British government. He had no intention of allowing a new American government to form with the powers, the same powers as the British government, which Americans fought for 7 years to overthrow. And that's exactly what they did, of course, at the Constitutional Convention. Henry refused to attend the Constitutional Convention because of his opposition to big government, which he considered totally unjust. He believed in justice, and he believed that a big government, a central government far from the people, was necessarily unjust because of the distance they maintained from the people. He believed that only local people, that people in the community who owned property and knew the affairs of that community, should govern that community.
So he was very distrustful of too much power being given to a central government, and that opposition became especially fierce at a moment when it appeared that such a government was an absolute necessity for this new nation to survive.
Absolutely. He was not opposed to a loose confederation, which is exactly what we had after the Revolutionary War. The Confederation of American States. He believed there should be some central authority with power to unite the states in common defense against foreign enemies and to regulate international trade and interstate trade. But he believed in local rule, in states' rights, and he fought for that all his life. He was a farmer. He was not a very wealthy man at first. He was a farmer, and like most farmers, he believed that the fruits of the earth were a gift from God as a reward for his toil and labor, and he was not about to share it with some distant government. He had nothing to do with government. Government gave nothing to him, and he didn't want to have anything to do with it. So he opposed taxation without representation, not just by Britain, but by the federal government. And he warned that the Constitution, the necessary and proper clause, as it's called in the Constitution, would give Congress the right to pass any laws it wanted to and enact any taxes it wanted to without the consent of the people. He wanted an amendment to force Congress to get approval of two-thirds of the state legislatures before enacting any federal tax. Of course, he didn't get that.
It's interesting to think about how different history might have unfolded had such a measure been approved.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that he was a farmer, but he was also a lawyer. And one of the little details in your book that I so appreciated is you tell us a little bit about his path towards becoming a lawyer and how for that time and place, it was a very different path from the one that it is now. Can you just say a word about that?
Yes, indeed. Well, there were no schools in the Hill Country, the Piedmont hills of central Virginia, where Henry grew up. So his parents educated him. His father was a well-educated, cultured Scotsman, a farmer also, and a justice of the peace. But he taught Henry basic grammar and English and mathematics, and went on to teach him history and science and Latin and Greek. Homeschooling was the rule in that part of the world at that time. And Henry then studied law on his own and became not only mastered law, he was a great, great student, and he was probably a genius. Certainly he was brilliant, but he not only mastered the law, he combined all the his mastery of the law and legal tactics with a fantastic sense of humor, which usually made opposition lawyers look like fools. And, of course, the jurors, being farmers, just like Henry, always embraced him. And he became the most successful, most brilliant courtroom lawyer in America at the time.
Hmm. One thing you tell us about Patrick Henry, the man, that is quite intriguing is his sort of conflicted beliefs about slavery. Or actually, that's kind of a wrong way to put it, because he had actually very strong beliefs about slavery itself. There really wasn't much conflict in that respect. But that was a bit at odds with what ended up happening with him and his life, and the fact that he ultimately did come into the ownership of slaves.
Yes, he never bought or sold any slaves himself. Many of the properties he bought came with slaves. They were property and part of the land. When you bought land, he despised slavery, as did George Washington. Most Virginia planters opposed slavery, and indeed, in the early part of the 18th century, Virginia planters had voted to ban slavery at a time when there were very few slaves in this country. But the English government overruled them, because the Royal Treasury needed the money and profits from the international slave trade. So that's why slavery came into Virginia. Virginia planters didn't invent slavery. It was not an American institution. They inherited it. And Patrick Henry was outraged by it. But by that time, because of British importation of slaves throughout the century, the slave population had reached 200,000. And it was now an impossible situation. These were largely illiterate, unskilled people. There was no way to free them. Where would they go in the South? The only work was for field hands. There were no cities or towns with opportunities for apprentice craftsmen. So this was an intractable problem now that wouldn't be solved until the Civil War, of course.
Mm-hmm. And you write at one point, the conflict of his moral opposition to slavery and his ownership of slaves tore at Patrick Henry's heart and mind throughout his life. You mentioned the state of Virginia. That's something else that is a very important element in Patrick Henry's story, is the fact that he is a man of Virginia, and that Virginia plays such a crucial role in many of these events, and particularly when America sort of comes to the decision to fight, it so much hinges on whether or not Virginia is pledged to be part of that fight. Just say a word about why Virginia was so important, and Patrick Henry's role as a Virginian in some of these crucial events.
Well, most Americans don't realize that Virginia, at the time of the Revolution, was America's largest, most powerful, richest, and most heavily populated state. It was huge. It stretched from Chesapeake Bay to the Mississippi River and up to the Great Lakes. It was a gigantic state. So the rest of the colonies could never have fought a revolution against Britain without the support of Virginia. And Patrick Henry was Virginia's first governor. Therefore, he was the most important civilian leader in colonies and in the new United States. His support of George Washington and the Continental Army was critical to victory. He ensured Virginia's giving more aid, more military support to the Continental Army than any other state. And then he himself sent troops into the West. It was he that was in charge of the Western campaign that seized the Illinois territory along with Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky from the British. That was all his doing. That had nothing to do with the Continental Army and Washington. So he was he played a critical role in the Revolutionary War. And then later, of course, when the Constitution was sent to the states for ratification. He led the opposition in Virginia, although he lost the fight. But without Virginia, even if the other 12 states had ratified the Constitution, there would have been no effective nation economically or politically. Virginia was just too important to the Americas at that time.
One of the most challenging things for us as modern Americans is to sort of place ourselves back in that day to understand how, for instance, the words of a Patrick Henry would be known to other colonists. I mean, and even for that matter, known to his fellow citizens of Virginia. And you talk about several moments in which Patrick Henry is almost ingenious in the way that he makes certain that his battle cry is heard by the people who need to hear it and be inspired by it.
Yes, one thing we have to remember is that the only people who could vote in those days were white males who owned property. So that meant the electorate was relatively small. 300-400 votes in a city was enough to put a man in office. There were 24 newspapers across the country. Most people were illiterate. The newspapers were circulated to the most educated and wealthiest Americans. It was a tight-knit community that ran this country. It was an oligarchy that ran in every state and eventually in the Congress. Most Americans had nothing to say about the running of this country. So it was relatively easy for a Washington, a Patrick Henry, a John Adams to come to power in their respective states and eventually in the national government.
One of the intriguing parallels between what was important to Patrick Henry and some of the conversation which is occurring now is with the modern Tea Party movement. I wonder if you could just say a word about the similarities and the contrasts which there might be between Patrick Henry, who he was, what was important to him, and what seems to be embodied by the so-called Tea Party movement of the present day.
Well, like Patrick Henry, whom I call the Lion of Liberty in my new book, like Patrick Henry, many Tea Party advocates resent the intrusion of the federal government and state government, of course, in our daily lives. The government is in every aspect of our lives, in our homes, in our workplaces, in our rivers and streams, in the water we drink, the air we breathe, everything we do. Everything is regulated by government nowadays. And even Washington would be turning over in his grave if he saw that. But Patrick Henry especially would be opposed to all government intrusion in people's personal lives. And many of the Tea Party supporters feel the same way. However, this is a different age and a different time, and it's interesting to see many of the Tea Party people who say they don't want government pork legislation, except in their own states. They don't want government bailouts to industries, except their particular industry. We don't see any people in Alaska or Colorado or Utah against bailouts for the mining industry, but they don't want any other. They don't want the financial industry in New York bailed out. So these Tea Party people are a little bit hypocritical talking about liberty and using Patrick Henry's words. You automatically deprive someone else of their liberty the minute you walk down the street. When you walk down a line, along a line on a street, it automatically deprives other people of walking along that line. This is a different urbanized society, crowded with people in America today. At the time of Patrick Henry, he lived an independent, self-sufficient life on a huge farm. He didn't need government. Government didn't need him. And he didn't want any intrusion in his life. He gladly got together with his neighbors to fight a common enemy, but that was it.
A quick word about the significance that Patrick Henry played in the enactment of the so-called Bill of Rights. Why was this important to him, and what role did he play?
Well, his main objection to the Constitution was that there was no guarantees of individual liberties. There was no guarantee of the right of free speech, the right of freedom of the press, religious freedom. As he said, when he examined the features of the Constitution, they appeared to him frightful. Where are your checks in this government? He said, there are no checks, no real balances. They are based on a supposition that your American governors shall be honest. He said, show me that age and country where the rights and liberties of the people were based on the chance of their rulers being honest men, and I'll show you a country that lost its liberties. He wanted specific guarantees of individual freedom to fight to prevent tyranny, and he wanted specific limits on the powers of the federal government. He got some of the guarantees of individual liberties in the Bill of Rights, that was the 10 amendments that were added to the Constitution in the first Congress. And he got a sop of limitation of federal government powers in the 10th Amendment. But basically, there were no limits ever imposed on the federal government to the extent that he wanted them. And the net result is that we've had presidents that have taken us into undeclared wars in all but five wars in history. All the wars we've ever been in, except for five, have been undeclared wars, which the president made the decision unilaterally. Similarly, we've had taxes after taxes imposed by the Congress and laws passed without really the consent of the people. We've had taxation without representation, much the same way that we had under England.
You sound like quite a fan of Patrick Henry and sympathetic to his attitude.
Well, I used the title Lion of Liberty for my book on him because that's what he was. He really believed in liberty and justice for all.
And, of course, it's important to be reminded that on some of these important questions, he was at odds with the great George Washington, who saw anarchy where Patrick Henry saw liberty.
Exactly. And this is a big debate even today. We have great difficulty, not only Americans, people all over the world, have great difficulty drawing the line between liberty and license. Where is that line? I don't think many people know how to draw it, especially when their own interests are at stake.
The book outlines all kinds of fascinating details about Patrick Henry's life and career, including the tragedy that befell his first wife due to mental illness, a great deal of information as we know it on some of his most famous speeches, and even Patrick Henry's connection to our own Civil War, all explored in this fascinating book called Lion of Liberty, Patrick Henry and the Call to a New Nation. It's a publication of Dacapo Press. Harlow Giles Unger, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, the day after the election, we will be having analysis from two political science professors at Carthage College, Dr. Jerry Mast and Dr. Jeff Roberg. On Thursday's morning show, it is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, serving up a program related to the environment around us. And on Friday, I'm very excited to speak not only with Herschel Kruger from the theater department, theater faculty at Carthage College, but also Oscar-winning playwright Eric Simonson, who has just penned a brand new play that receives its world premiere this weekend at Carthage, a play called Up and Away. the Racine Theater Guild just performed his best-known play, Lombardi. The morning show airs every weekday morning between